Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is John Caney, Executive Director and co-founder of Reinvent Albany. Reinvent Albany is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, tax-exempt charitable organization that promotes open, accountable New York State government with an interest in government transparency and public participation. John Caney, welcome back to the Capital Connection.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Let's start with the end of session. It got toppled over a bit by the fact that Governor Hochul canceled the congestion pricing plan, which had been put into place, and really no plan to fund it after dumping the plan. And I know you've had to say a lot about it, calling her decision to stop congestion pricing in New York City as a daft plan. So we'll start there. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, we, Reinvent Albany and many others, believe that Governor Hochul's decision to interfere with congestion pricing being turned on by the MTA was one of the worst decisions and biggest debacles, fiascos, you pick the word, daft works to that we've ever seen in New York State. The reason for that is because, one, as governor, she's choosing to ignore the law, a.k.a. break the law, which congestion pricing was passed as part of law in 2019. And the governor, in fact, does not have the legal authority to just ignore laws that she does not like, despite. And so we're not just disappointed, we're dismayed by the complete failure of her stewardship and dereliction of duty, basically, in coming and just interfering with the law that was passed years ago and has been going through a public process that has involved, wait for it, 200 public meetings at least over 4 years, and an incredibly elaborate environmental impact statement, et cetera, et cetera. And the damage that she has done to her own reputation here by this extremely reckless act and to the economy of the whole state is phenomenal. I mean, this is a governor that likes to talk about jobs and affordability. And as Reinvent Albany has shown in a couple of reports, her actions are directly endangering 103,000 to 110,000 full-time New York State jobs, and this is a stunning, stunning act of foolishness by the governor. Not just for people who care about the MTA and subway, bus, train riders in downstate, but also for hundreds of thousands of jobs in upstate where the MTA buys all kinds of stuff, ranging from full rail cars to, you know, those yellow plastic strips that go on the side of subway platforms. So we think it's pretty notable that some of the governor's usually staunchest allies in Albany, including the big real estate interests from New York City and big corporate interests that really are the backbone of the governor's institutional support, have just been blasting her for this. And it's hard to overstate what a total blunder this is, because there is no plan B, plan C, plan D to replace the revenue, which is $15 billion in MPA capital funds, because the MPA has already budgeted and essentially spent via planning that money. And any plan B or plan C, new tax, new revenue source, takes away money from the next capital plan for the MTA, which starts next year. So it's just, it's a mind blower of a foolish thing for the governor to have done and detonated on the last day of session, essentially, or the last couple of days of the session, which had a cascading effect of also crowding out some important environmental legislation that has long been sought to help combat global warming. And all in all, just a tremendously bad way to end the session and really, really cast doubt on the governor's judgment and her common sense.
You're listening to The Capital Connection. He is John Caney, Executive Director and co-founder of Reinvent Albany. I'm David Gustina. I mean, you're quite right. After this happened, I spoke with Liz Krueger. She was very upset about this. Of course, the other part that I don't think you mentioned the crowding out of the environmental legislation, but congestion pricing is environmental, right? Because you'd reduce congestion in the city, less cars, less pollution. Then you have the other side of this, because, you know, the question comes, if you're bewildered, then why would she do it? Well, because you're going to charge people $15, right, for entering the city, lower Manhattan. And that issue is seen by many in the political world as another tax. You'll be taxing people coming in from upstate and, you know, New Jersey and all these places that surround the city. And that was part of her argument. So does it make any sense? Is that why she did it? What do you think?
I mean, the gossip or the thinking is that Albany insider thinking is that the governor was asked by Democrats, national Democrats, to, quote, pause congestion pricing or pull the plug on it to appease suburban voters who were disgruntled about it, so as to and in that way to protect potential Democratic congressional House seats in Long Island and the Mid-Hudson, New York City suburbs. That's the reasoning for it. The idiotic thing about that is that nobody likes, no member of the public likes toll hikes or tax hikes or fees. And if you ask anyone, you know, would you rather have a free lunch or pay for lunch? They're going to say, sure, if it's the same lunch, I'd rather have it for free. Why not? So there's no such thing as a popular usage toll hike or a tax hike that people want. But guess what? The tax on employees under the and payroll tax under the MTA's payroll mobility tax, which is one of its biggest sources of revenue, is extremely unpopular with employers and labor unions. And yet it was still voted on and passed. Why? Because it's essential. And so this is this belief, and we've had people from the governor's office and third parties explain that it's an existential choice for the Democratic Party. You either cancel congestion pricing or you will lose Congress. Is, we think, a complete, utter BS fabrication and fake equation. And by the way, what's really sad about this, on top of many things, is that there's lots and lots of polling and public opinion data from other places in the world that have been doing congestion pricing for a long time, especially London and Stockholm. And both of them show that public approval of congestion pricing was at the absolute low in the weeks right before it was turned on. And that even in the week after they turned it on, it started getting more and more popular because it was just a real thing and people started accommodating and seeing some benefits. So it was well known that the polls were going to show congestion pricing being unpopular right before it was turned on. And the interesting thing is it's not even that unpopular. The numbers are roughly like they are in Stockholm and London 20 years ago before they had congestion pricing there. And now in both places, there is overwhelming support publicly for congestion pricing. So along with saying that none of that is a surprise and it just comes out of nowhere. And that's why so many people are so mad and disappointed in the governor about this decision, because there was nothing really changed from 2019 when the law was passed to when the governor made her decision to interfere. And I'm going to use the word interfere because, as you will see in a number of lawsuits that will be filed in the weeks ahead, the governor is breaking the law. She does not have the actual legal authority to stop congestion pricing. The way she is doing it is by withholding her signature, in this case, the signature of her agency, the state DOT, from some federal paperwork. That's her power is withholding that. So there's much more to be said and done on this, but very disappointing that a governor who likes to pride herself on kind of an aw shucks, roll up her sleeves, common sense approach to politics and living has done something that just so utterly lacking in good sense. Just really, really dumb move by her. So don't know what else can add to that other than, this is going to create big problems for employers all over upstate. The people that make those yellow subway platform edge, they're called tactile strips for subway platforms. The company that makes those is in Buffalo, New York. You know, that's what this means, is that things like that are not going to be purchased because congestion revenue, the pricing revenue is not going to come in. And as you point out, these are all green jobs. I mean, these are the jobs that are the much sought after favorite flavor of jobs. And so this is just a direct hit on the idea of a green economy or economic growth upstate. And that it's just very hard to stomach the governor's pronouncements about being a jobs affordability governor. She's busy just absolutely blowing a gigantic hole in the upstate economy, or what's left of it, the manufacturing economy, by doing this.
We're speaking with John Caney. He is the executive director of Reinvent Albany. You can find out more at reinventalbany.org. Now, John, I can't let this go because you said, and this was the speculation at the time, will there be lawsuits? You said there are a number of lawsuits coming. Can you give us a hint, any more information on that? Who's going to be suing?
Oh, for sure. There will be state lawsuits, at least one that directly challenges the governor's legal authority to interfere with the 2019 state law creating congestion pricing. And then there will be some, at least one, maybe more federal lawsuits that will be challenging the governor's violating federal protections for vulnerable communities and environmental violations. And the exact who it is being worked out right now as we speak. There's a couple different legal teams that we are aware of that are talking to potential plaintiffs. And, the public should see some kind of legal complaints in the weeks to a month ahead.
Well, that's interesting. We will keep on that story, obviously, as it goes forward. Now, John, what about the general issue of transparency in budget negotiations? You know, I believe back in March when the budget was coming due, we were in Sunshine Week, talking about sunlight and information getting out there. But despite all that, it still seems to be three people in a room in the end kind of making the decisions.
Yeah, I mean, look, New York is challenging for idealists and optimists who think that democratic government, that is small d government that's selected by the people through elections, should be transparent. And the state is going backwards right now on transparency. The reality is that the budget process continues to be totally opaque and dominated by leadership at the end of the day. It's all backdoor. The governor continues to use messages of necessity when she can, which allow the legislature to introduce and pass bills without any public scrutiny at all. And that's a power that's supposed to be reserved for, you know, dire emergency, not as a regular way of passing budgets. The freedom of information law process in New York State is completely broken.
How so, John? How is that broken? That's freedom of information law, something journalists and the public should rely on more. But we find this in journalism all the time. You know, they don't respond. They delay. You know, they wait until it's too late.
So the groups that are fully engaged on trying to improve freedom of information law, which is probably the most basic tool that the public has for open government, are mad as hell right now, because what they're seeing is that requests for simple, basic information that should take a week, a month, can take as much as a year, or are simply never responded to. You get a pro forma response that says, hey, thanks for asking, now abandon hope, basically. And the system is collapsing. And it's collapsing in part because there's such a huge demand, but also because the state government and local governments don't take it seriously. The Freedom of Information offices are underfunded and understaffed to a point that there's just a dereliction of duty. It appears like it's deliberate.
Yeah, I think it is deliberate, don't you? I mean, look, we can't get real ethics reform in New York, and now you're having trouble. I mean, you've always had kind of trouble with this FOIL law here in New York, but you really don't have the respect, politician side of the aisle, that this is a responsibility of government that is paid for by the public.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is journalists and watchdogs tend to have a very different view on transparency than the Albany insiders and the big dog interest groups, the hospital industry or public sector unions, all of which are not very friendly to freedom of information law or any kind of transparency. And the more money you have and the bigger dog you are in Albany, the less you like transparency, because your actions are on display. And that's embarrassing, because looking at how the sausage is made is not pretty, given the amount of pay to play and just general misbehavior in Albany.
It's so interesting that it comes down to people not wanting to be embarrassed. But, you know, why would they pass legislation to watch after themselves more?
So just to put it in context, so it's not just, oh, this guy's crazy. New York is one of the few states that does not require campaign contributors to list their employers. So who do you work for? So it's very, very hard to figure out how many contributions are going to a PAC or a campaign from a individual company that may be getting state subsidies or have a big interest in a particular law. And the states like California, the United States federal government, places like New York City all require that you list who your employer is when you make a campaign contribution. So the public can see that in databases and gets a pretty good idea of who's trying to buy influence with their contributions. In New York State, that's been laws to do basic transparency things like that have just faltered year after year after year. And that seems like, wow, that's pretty esoteric. Who the hell cares? But it ends up being that journalists like yourself can't even write pieces saying, oh, look what's happening here. You know, this company is trying to influence this bill or this action, because it's invisible to you. You don't know who works for that company without, you know, laborious effort. So there's a lot of pieces in the transparency picture in New York that the leadership of both the legislature and the governor are deliberately keeping from being completed. And as a result, New York tends to have fairly crummy government by United States standards, and which is measurable through the amount of money that New York spends to deliver the same services, whether it's school aid or spending on health outcomes. What you see is that New York has pretty mediocre results for being, despite spending the most in most areas of government activity. I mean, New York's very good at spending a lot of money, New York government, and very bad at measuring the effectiveness of that spending or the transparency. And you could say, well, you know, that's inevitable, but it's not so much. And I think it's there's kind of a fatalism in New York that it has to be that way here, that actually is ahistoric, because for probably 100 years or so, New York State had the best state government in the U.S. During the entire period of industrial, when New York was at its, you know, greatest height, when every upstate city that's now kind of reeling from population loss was an economic powerhouse. Your Syracuse's, your Rochester's, your Buffalo's. During that same era, New York State government was known for innovation and creating new laws, new approaches to all kinds of different aspects of government. So we think that those things go hand in hand, and that you're not going to have a dynamic state that's bustling and growing when you have a government that is too often an obstacle and not a help. And the COVID really, really showed how important government is to the most vulnerable. And we're yet not learning so many lessons from COVID and what happened with it that we should be learning. So there's, you know, if you believe in the power of government, which our group does, just in case you think, oh, these guys want to get rid of government and cut taxes and everything. Now we are big believers in the power of government as the one force that we all share that can perform collective actions for the collective good. But that doesn't mean that it's a progressive thing to accept government that doesn't work very well, or that's overly expensive, or that, you know, bad at providing services. Because at the end of the day, the rich don't need government, and the poor and the vulnerable do. So when your government stinks, the rich don't suffer from that. It's the poorest and most vulnerable among you. And that's something that we have been pushing now for more than a decade, that a lot of New Yorkers involved in influencing government do not want to hear, because they are so wrapped up in their own narrow silo, you know, of their specific interests, that they've kind of lost sight of the broader good. And that's a big problem. And it's why there's not a strong impulse for reforming state government in New York, despite its huge size and importance.
Yeah, I want to throw in another element here, and this is from my experience in the media, as the media landscape has changed. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One, I can't get the governor, her office, for example, to respond to me, to respond to my request for interviews. A lot of politicians, not just the governor, but they play this game where they just don't respond, or they have no interest in talking to you about issues, and they avoid you. That's fine. That's the adversarial relationship has been going on for years. But now what happens also is, because they all have their own little YouTube sites, or they can get media out through their social media, they do it that way. So it's easier for them to say, for example, to public broadcasting, where we are, oh, well, I don't have to go there. When in the past, I think most public officials, most politicians saw it as their public obligation to come on to public broadcasting and share what they know about New York State government and politics with the public. And then beyond that, ultimately, what you end up with is not getting the information to New Yorkers who deserve that information, and a workaround. So, for example, their websites, there's no uniformity. You go on many of these legislators' websites and this stuff is sitting there for 5 years and there's no updates. So they're not even keeping up with their own social media. And, you know, we're in 2024. What's happening?
I think what's happening is that public expectations are pretty darn low. And collectively, the public have been beaten into a sense of low expectations and not believing things can change. And that's fatal for democracies, because if we're not changing and going with changes in society, which include everything from technology, just incredible advances in technology, to who New Yorkers are demographically and people coming in and people going out, then government gets more and more disconnected. And then you have big societal problems. And we do.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where I was going. You can't have a democracy without information that you can trust.
Yeah, and I would just point to one key thing. I was speaking a bit vaguely about COVID, but the report that the governor's office released, a consultant report that was supposed to be the ultimate after-action report, as they called it, for COVID, all the lessons learned. But the people doing it had no subpoena power, no ability to compel testimony. It wasn't like a public hearing. And as a result, is missing a lot of key information and insight. And that's a perfect example of where having a public reckoning, a reconciliation, a here's the truth, so many people died, how do we keep this horror from ever happening again, is not happening. We're not doing anything to honor those that died.
Yeah, especially those that didn't have to die, let's say.
Yes.
Well, John Caney, executive director and co-founder of Reinvent Albany, we're out of time. I had so much more to talk to you about. Maybe next time when you come back, we can have you talk about industrial development agencies.
Whenever you have me, I'm happy to be back. I thank you.
Thanks, John.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustino.
Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.